Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. The three West African countries at the heart of an Ebola epidemic have recorded their first week with no new cases since the UN World Health Organization recognized the outbreak in March 2014, it said on Wednesday. More than 11,000 people have died in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone in the world's worst outbreak of Ebola, but there were no new cases in the week to October 4th, it said. The United States will not cooperate militarily with Russia and Syria because its strategy is tragically flawed. That's according to U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter Wednesday. He spoke to journalists during a news conference with his Italian counterpart, Roberta Pinotti.
Russia has the wrong strategy. They continue to hit targets that are not ISIL. We believe this is a fundamental mistake. Despite what the Russians say, we have not agreed to cooperate with Russia so long as they continue to pursue a mistaken strategy and hit these targets.
Secretary Carter's comments come as Russia said Wednesday it has used four warships in the Caspian Sea to launch rockets at Islamic State targets in Syria. The Russian defense minister told Vladimir Putin that the vessels fired 26 cruise missiles and at 11 IS targets. Suicide bombers targeted a town in northeastern Nigeria Wednesday, killing at least 15 people. Nigeria's emergency management agency says three bombers set off explosives in the town of Damotoru in Yobe State. Witnesses say one of the early morning attacks was near a mosque filled with people at prayer, while another struck a housing development. At least a dozen people were taken to the hospital for injuries. So far, there's been no claim of responsibility. VOA News. Europe has reacted too slowly to the turmoil on its borders that produced a huge wave of refugees. That assessment comes from French President François Hollande in a joint speech to the European Parliament with the German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Hollande says, "I acknowledge that Europe was slow in understanding that tragedy in the Middle East or Africa could not but have consequences for Europe itself." The comments by both the German and French leaders come as the European Union has started a new operation in the South Mediterranean Sea to intercept human trafficking boats trying to enter the bloc illegally. The Iraqi military says it has entered the Anbar province capital of Ramadi from the west and is attempting to advance on the city center of the city. Edward Uranian reports from Cairo.
Iraqi state TV is reporting government forces have entered the Anbar province capital of Ramadi from its western outskirts after clearing mines and other booby traps laid by Islamic State militants. VOA could not independently confirm the extent of the Iraqi advance. Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi insisted during a speech Wednesday that Iraq does not want foreign ground troops to help in the battle against Islamic State and that air operations must be coordinated with the Iraqi military. He denied that security cooperation with Russia had begun. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
A Palestinian woman stabbed an Israeli man who then shot and wounded her in Jerusalem's old city. It came after Israel lifted some of the tight security measures imposed after a series of Palestinian attacks. A suspected Palestinian militant later stabbed an Israeli soldier in the southern Israeli town of Kiryat Gat before being pursued by security forces and shot dead, according to police. The new head of the disgraced German automaker Volkswagen said Wednesday that he hopes the company can begin recalling vehicles in January 2016 and perhaps finish repairing all the vehicles affected by its emissions cheating scandal by the end of the year. Matthias Müller told a German newspaper in an interview published Wednesday that he hopes to have all the 11 million affected vehicles adjusted within a year's time. The Nobel Prize Committee in Stockholm, Sweden, has awarded this year's Nobel Prize in Chemistry to three scientists. This is the Secretary General of the organization, Göran Hansen.
The Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences has decided to award the 2015 Nobel Prize in Chemistry jointly to Thomas Lindahl, Paul Modrich, and Aziz Sanjar for mechanistic studies of DNA repair.
I'm Frances Alonso, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Swuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Certainly the crisis after World War II was much larger, and actually I think it's important to keep that in mind in order to put what's going on now in perspective.
That's University of Michigan Associate Professor Pamela Bollinger comparing Europe's migrant and refugee crisis to World War II. Details coming up.
Also in the news, the World Bank says economic growth in Africa has fallen largely because of a falling global commodity price. And 15 Nigerians died in a mosque in the city of Damaturu in Yobe State this morning when two women carrying explosives under their garments detonated their bombs.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on African News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the general in charge of the failed coup in Burkina Faso last month has been formally charged along with one other top official accused of supporting the overthrow of Burkina Faso's government. General Gilbert Diendere and Jibril Bassolé, a former foreign minister, were charged yesterday with attacking state security. During the failed coup, Diendere's forces in the elite presidential guard detained the interim president, prime minister, and several cabinet members. The guard was unhappy the interim government barred supporters of former President Blaise Compaoré from running in upcoming elections. Compaoré was ousted in a popular uprising in October of last year as he tried to extend his 27 years in office. General Diendere held power for nearly a week, but was forced to step down under pressure from the army, demonstrators, and the West African bloc ECOWAS. Diendere gave himself up last week following negotiations with officials in the capital, Ouagadougou. Bassolé, who served as foreign minister under Compaoré, has denied any connection with the coup. Both men remain in custody. Burkina Faso was planning to hold presidential and parliamentary elections on October 11th. It remains unclear when that vote will take place.
Fifteen Nigerians died in a mosque in the city of Damaturu in Yobe State this morning when two women carrying explosives under their garments detonated their bombs. Only hours before the mosque bombing, about 100 Boko Haram fighters launched an attack on a rural army camp near the village of Goniri. A military spokesman said the insurgents were repulsed, but seven troops died and nine were injured. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs says the six-year Islamist insurgency in northeastern Nigeria has created the fastest-growing displacement crisis in Africa. It estimates that 2.5 million people have fled their homes in Nigeria, Cameroon, Chad, and Niger. And it says government forces are starting to have an effect, but the humanitarian response is starved of funds and is straining at the seams.
The World Bank says economic growth in Africa will fall to a low not seen since 2009, a drop largely caused by falling global commodity prices. VOA's Anita Powell looks at the report and what it means from Johannesburg.
The famous Africa Rising narrative appears to have hit a road bump, with the World Bank predicting in a new report that economic growth on the continent will slow to 3.7% this year. The bank's vice president for Africa, Makhtar Diop, says the main culprit is obvious. Falling global commodity prices have a huge impact on African economies, many of which rely on exporting raw materials.
Today's external environment is changing. We have a slowdown of major economies in Africa, in the world, but also we have commodity prices we have been falling dramatically. That is raising a certain number of challenges for African countries.
He also noted other factors, like China's economic slowdown, the tightening of global financial conditions, and African nations' chronic problems with supplying enough electricity. But Martin Davis, Managing Director of Emerging Markets in Africa at Deloitte Frontier Advisory, says the numbers are skewed by the large resource-rich economies like Nigeria, Angola, and South Africa. East African nations, which don't have the benefit of massive deposits of oil, gas, or minerals, are actually doing pretty well. The bank acknowledges that in its report, pointing out that countries not known as resource giants, like Ethiopia, Ivory Coast, Mozambique, Rwanda, and Tanzania, are expected to see about 7% growth in the coming year. Still, Davis notes, every nation should implement policies that promote stable long-term growth. One way to do that, he says, is to privatize moribund state industries, a pill that might be politically difficult to swallow.
This needs to be a wake-up call. Countries in our region, amongst many other regions, also think Latin America particularly, have become drunk on overpriced commodities-driven growth. Now we need to start to move away from that, be less complacent.
Economists have predicted that low oil prices will persist for some time, which means this slump could be a blessing in disguise. As African nations are forced to figure out how to escape the old narrative of being the world's resource providers and truly rise on their own. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
The European Union has launched a naval campaign called Operation Sophia to board and seize vessels in the Mediterranean that carry migrants to Europe. Italy's aircraft carrier Cavour has led the monitoring of migrants trafficking in the Mediterranean since June, with rotating naval support from Germany and Britain. Britain's HMS Richmond has now joined the European Union naval force in its efforts to stop the human trafficking. However, an official of the UN International Office for Migration, IOM, says the ocean-going enforcement will fail unless the EU also takes on criminal gangs in Europe that are involved in arms and drugs smuggling, as well as human trafficking. IOM European Region Director Eugenio Ambrosi says the transnational criminal rings of traffickers are the same as those involved in weapons and drugs.
More than 130,000 migrants have sailed from North Africa to Europe so far this year. An estimated 2,700 of those are believed to have drowned. German Chancellor Angela Merkel and French President François Hollande are expected to appear before the European Parliament today to discuss the migrant crisis. In Budapest, the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee in the Hungarian Parliament says they have joined with Poland, the Czech Republic, and Slovakia to control the flow of migrants at the EU's external borders. Zoe Namath says it's a model for all EU countries. However, UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Saeed Ra'ad Al Hussein cautioned the EU Justice and Home Affairs Council on Tuesday that measures to manage the massive migrant flows do not become detention centers in disguise.
Europe's refugee crisis has been described by many as the largest there since World War II, but is that an accurate comparison? Pamela Bollinger is a University of Michigan Associate Professor of History and an expert on refugees, human rights, and displacement. She spoke to VOA's Jody Capua about the influx of hundreds of thousands of migrants and refugees to Europe and how it compares to the Second World War.
I think that for Europe, in terms of the magnitude, it certainly is the largest refugee crisis since World War II, but Europe has also experienced, as we know, a number of significant refugee crises since World War II, particularly the Hungarian refugee crisis and the refugee flows produced by the wars in Yugoslavia in the 1990s. Probably in terms of numbers, this is the largest, but it depends on how you want to reckon magnitude. This perhaps is impacting the most countries within Europe at the same moment, also makes it seem like a greater emergency. But certainly the crisis after World War II was much larger, and actually I think it's important to keep that in mind in order to put what's going on now in perspective.
It's also, I guess, important to keep in mind that Europe was a shambles after World War II, so conditions were a lot different, no?
Right, of course. And that's the thing is, although Europe is still struggling with the effects of the Great Recession at the moment, as you say, after 1945, so much of continental Europe was actually in ruins. And some people estimate that
on Victory Europe Day, there were as many as 11 million displaced persons in Europe. So that gives some pause to think about when people say that Europe is at its limits and can't absorb anymore. Actually, the magnitude of the crisis was so much higher in 1945, and Europe was in very devastated conditions to deal with the refugee problem then.
I also know that you look into the human rights aspects of refugee crises, and we're hearing a number of countries opposing the required quotas for the resettlement of refugees. Hungary seems to be leading the way. What does this tell you about this ongoing crisis?
Well, it reminds us that, unfortunately, many declarations and conventions on human rights are ultimately non-binding. They rely upon good faith or pressure of certain kinds, but they're very difficult to enforce at the international level when countries who have signed on to those agreements decide that they don't want to honor them in practice. But I think there is a groundswell, obviously, around the understanding and notion of human rights. And I think the flip side of the negative responses of a country like Hungary, the official level, are the grassroots efforts that many Europeans have undertaken to assist refugees. I think here we see many Europeans have a very deep commitment to the idea of human rights and see it as central to the identity of the European Union and to the post-1945 Europe. And so I think it's important to remember that there are many in Europe who really are working in the name of the human rights of these displaced persons who are coming into Europe.
Let me ask you about the impact of the refugee flows. First, let me ask you about the negative effects of the inflow. What do you see happening?
Unfortunately, I haven't been in Europe myself since June, but certainly the impacts in the first instance, you have an acute humanitarian crisis, right? There's a kind of organizational, logistical problem that is created. How do we care for these people? How do we provide them with immediate services, food, water, housing, and so on? Then there's the larger question of settling these refugees. How do you integrate them into economic and cultural systems, social systems that are very different from the ones in which they came? And then even when there's goodwill, then the political question, you know, so we're seeing this now with the criticism of Merkel. Merkel has put Germany at the forefront of the European countries, willing to take refugees, but of course she faces political opposition at home because, as usually happens, domestic constituencies say, well, we have our own problems. Why are we dedicating these resources to others?
Could the refugees actually help Europe?
Oh, I think so. One can think of them as a resource. They need workers of particular kinds. And one of the things that I've been struck by in the coverage of this crisis, we see so many not only articulate refugees who've been interviewed, but refugees who are extremely fluent in English and other European languages. Many of them have linguistic resources that already will facilitate at least their integration.
That's University of Michigan Associate Professor Pamela Bollinger. She spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua.
The International Organization for Migration says it is the target of a disinformation campaign in Central African Republic. Lisa Schlein reports from IOM headquarters in Geneva.
The International Organization for Migration says a defamation campaign in Central African Republic has been going on since its headquarters in the capital, Bangui, was attacked more than 1 week ago. It says the IOM office was extensively ransacked and aid intended for thousands of people sheltered in displacement camps was stolen. IOM spokesman Joel Millman says while the looting was taking place, reports began surfacing in the international and social media claiming IOM was harboring weapons. He says these media reports also accused IOM of taking sides in the sectarian violence.
We want to point out that there were never any weapons or any offensive weapons in our headquarters in Bangui, but there were approximately 35 self-protection kits. I believe those are Kevlar armored vests and helmets that a lot of international aid agencies keep on hand. 35 have gone missing. We presume they're with the looters.
The September 27th attack on IOM headquarters followed the murder of a young Muslim man in Bangui the previous day. That killing triggered a resurgence of widespread ethnic and religious fighting in Central African Republic. Dozens of people were left dead and scores injured. Milman tells VOA he does not know who is behind the disinformation campaign, but that it has a lot to do with what he calls religious competition.
The violence started with the rumor of a pedicab driver who was murdered, and that triggered a rampage against Christian neighborhoods. I can only speculate that whoever is involved in that violence sees their opposite religious group as in our pocket.
Milman says these false rumors must be squashed immediately before they gain a kind of legitimacy. He says they are putting IOM staff in the country in danger. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
African air traffic safety and security experts are calling for more investment to guarantee safe air travel on the continent. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaounde.
Ghanaian-born Africa aviation expert Ose Bonsu says Africa accounts for barely 5% of global air traffic, but reported 20% of accidents and fatalities in 2014.
We need a coordinated effort to be able to build rescue centers where we can pick as soon as it happens, we call and then they move. Now what is happening individually is that most countries are using their air force as a coordinated centers. The aircraft dropped, if it is in the ocean, the people they contact is their air force. They move them to the spot just to locate. And after locating, how do you rescue? That is the challenge.
Bonsu says more training is needed on air traffic management as the number of flights continue to multiply. Air navigation safety expert Sidi Koni says scores of small air companies operate in sub-Saharan Africa without respecting international norms. Losing track of planes is an issue.
Nous nous retrouvons pour voir si il y a des points d'amélioration.
He says traffic coordination and communication need to improve. Connie says they have to make sure planes do not find themselves on the same routes as they move through the region. Air traffic controllers in Africa say they lack personnel and proper communication equipment. Safety experts gathered in Cameroon this week said air traffic personnel in some countries must rely on mobile phone networks. Power outages at airports and animals trespassing on runways are also among the top frustrations and dangers, they said. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaounde.
Minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. For decades, efforts by governments, NGOs, and agriculture scientists to end hunger and malnutrition have focused on productivity, that is, the quantity of food produced. Today, those same stakeholders are becoming just as interested in the vitamins and minerals that food contains, or the nutritional quality of the food. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with the economist Howard Buis, director of Harvest Plus, it's a Washington, D.C. nonprofit group that breeds more nutritious plants and shares these foods with Africa and the world.
Our target is to improve mineral and vitamin intakes. And what distinguishes us is that we're breeding plants to put more minerals and vitamins in the food staples that the poor eat day in and day out.
You're actually creating new kinds of plants, right?
Yes. The way I express it is that we're getting the plants to do the work. There are a couple of advantages using the plant breeding strategy. The first is that we start with the smallholder farmers who are growing the crops that they eat. And when you have the fortified foods that are made in the factories, they often don't reach the rural areas. The second is that it's cost effective. By getting the plants to do the work, once they're in the food system, you don't have recurrent costs. So essentially, the vitamin A and the iron and the zinc is coming free to the households.
Now, is this the same as so-called genetically modified crops? I mean, that people are kind of concerned about it in the United States. Maybe they can afford to be.
It's not. We're using conventional plant breeding. We're just crossing high-yielding varieties with the high-nutrient varieties and getting high-yielding, high-nutrient varieties so that we're not using the GMO technology at all.
What is your approach in terms of getting traditional farms to use this? Are there any challenges in terms of getting people on board to actually plant these plants?
Well, we really have two messages for the farmers. The first is that our crops are just as high yielding and just as productive, so you're not sacrificing profits from the crops. They can also be sold in the market. Farmers are always looking for that. But then you get the added value of the extra vitamins and minerals in the crops.
Let me see if I understand what Harvest Plus does more carefully. Is it that you develop these things or you just sort of advocate for them? I mean, what is your involvement in it? A lot of people obviously are in the business of trying to make food more nutritious.
Well, the plant breeding process takes a while to develop the crops. To do the crossing to get the high yields and the high minerals and vitamins in the crops is an 8 to 10 year process to develop them. Then once they're approved for release in the countries, now we're involved in the job of getting them out to farmers and scaling up. We have the varieties now released in 28 different countries around the world. Now that we're getting the crops out to farmers, we're partnering with NGOs to take our crops and incorporating them in their programs, in the programs of the NGOs, in reaching out to farmers in developing countries. What we're doing now is quite a bit different than when Harvest Plus got started in 2003. So in the beginning, we had to prove that we could develop these crops in high-yielding backgrounds. There was some doubt about that. And we released our first varieties in 2012 in Africa. We also had to do nutrition studies. We had to prove that when vitamin A deficient, iron deficient, zinc deficient people ate our crops, that we could improve their mineral and vitamin status. And now we've done those nutrition studies and we've convinced the nutrition community that we can make a significant contribution to reducing mineral and vitamin deficiencies. Now in the last 2 or 3 years, now that the crops are released, our focus is on extension to farmers and convincing consumers to eat these crops. So we're really into delivery and scaling up now. The governments are really quite excited. Initially, we chose target countries where we introduced a single crop. And in every case, the governments have said, why aren't you bringing all your crops to our country? Why are you just bringing a single crop? It's really gratifying to see all this time and effort that's gone into this starting to have some real impact.
That was Howard Buis, director of Harvest Plus, an international program of agricultural scientists and nutrition and food policy experts based in Washington, D.C. Buis spoke with the VOA's Adam Phillips in New York.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali coming up at 18:30 UTC. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Kelvin Fowler, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, Riek Machar, South Sudan's opposition leader and former vice president, will sit down with host Shaka Sali. We'll discuss the recent peace accord and examine the country's uncertain future as the November deadline for the agreement draws near. That's Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on Straight Talk Africa.